Welcome to Northpod Law, Series 6, Episode 1, recorded on the 26th of September, 2012. Take the power back.
Series 6, who'd have thought it?
We're back.
Yeah.
And we've got a new Jonathan.
We have. We've got a new Jonathan. Jonathan can't be with us tonight. He's been imprisoned in a jail cell in Thailand. well, he's not here to argue about it, is he? Instead, we have Solicitor Ian Owen with us.
Hello.
Hello. We've got a lot to get through. We'll tell you in a moment why Ian's here. But first of all, you will have no doubt seen that a number of the things... what was in the news during the last 6 weeks of things that we've talked about on the show.
That's assuming that they've been paying attention. They haven't just had 6 weeks off.
And we also have picked up a number of new listeners, I've noticed, since we've been
off
there.
Yeah. Welcome to you all.
Absolutely. So let's just have a bit of a roundup of things that have gone on so far.
All right. So in case anybody has actually been locked up in a prison cell in Thailand and has missed the Hillsborough report, the Hillsborough report is out. That's it. Move on.
That's a short news article.
We might actually be covering this in a future show in rather more detail, but do you know, it doesn't really feel much like news, the Hillsborough thing altogether. Oh, look at that. What a big shock. The police have been covering up evidence and not really quite telling the truth and exaggerating things they didn't really need to if they'd just said what happened in the first place.
It does perhaps have some interesting... elements from a legal point of view. Obviously, there's the question of criminal charges and things, which we're going to have to leave well alone.
Well and
for
truly,
now,
yes.
So as not to prejudice anything along those lines. But, of course, there was a lot of litigation stemming from the Hillsborough disaster. All law students will be familiar with Alcock, White, and things like that, nervous shock cases, and so on. The question arises whether the devil is in the detail of the released documents now, and whether any of the suppositions, any of the matters in the contemplation of the House of Lords, as it then was, or the lower court, of course, are affected now. If any of that is proven to be incorrect, now it's been a long while since I studied that, and even longer since either of you two did. Absolutely,
young
because I'm so youthful. You see, if Jonathan was here, he probably wouldn't remember it.
Hills what?
Yeah,
definitely.
We learned about it in history, So the point of it is that we want to just re-examine that and see whether there are any legal consequences for cases that have already been. We hope to have. A guest in relation to that. As listeners to the show will know, I don't often trail guests on this show because it doesn't sometimes happen.
He never learns. Come on, listeners. It's every single week. Next week, we're going to be doing this. I kick him every week under the table.
It's true. But never mind. We'll see if we can get her here. We should do because she's my old university lecturer. I should be able to pull that one, surely.
You're going to pull your old university lecturer. That's a matter for you.
I think we'll move on. What else has been in the news, Kirsten?
Well, same sort of theme, really, isn't it? Are the police telling the truth about Andrew Mitchell, Chief Whip?
Yeah, now, at the moment, so that in case you, again, have not paid any attention to this, this is the Tory Chief Whip who wanted to take his push bike through the main entrance, the
gates Downing Street.
Of Downing Street. Those of you who are interested in such things know that the security in front of Downing Street, preventing it being a public right-of-way, has changed a little in law in recent days, recent years, because of the terrorism implications. It is still, actually, even before this incident, before Andrew Mitchell, if you can remember such a time, that there were ongoing disputes about whether the public had a right-of-way down Downing Street.
Well, they always used to.
Yeah.
Well, I remember standing right outside number 10 and being able to... You know, being taken down, going, "Oh, look, that's number 10, however old I was.
Yeah. I was thinking,
1852, apparently, looking at the way Ben's looking at me at the moment.
Well, no, I was just thinking, you know, you look at number 10 Downing Street and you stand outside that and then compare it to the White House, and it really is just so very British in every sense.
Oh, yeah,
isn't it?
It's very understated. Absolutely. We don't go in for any of that great pomp. Not with the politicians, anyway.
No, quite. But anyway, the point arising from that, or the point that may arise from that, twofold, really. And if you have any particular views on this, this isn't the Jeremy Vine show, so keep them to yourself. But the The two points, I suppose, massively rising in the press are the question of, well, he's a road user with his push bike, and this officer was asking him to stop being a road user and, in fact, take his bike onto the pavement.
This is actually has not been raised anywhere. Have you actually heard it now?
I was listening to the Jeremy
Fox. Oh, really?
Sorry.
Somebody's obviously been listening to my husband.
Yeah, no,
actually, you're
quite
right.
He
said, actually, when is someone going to raise the cyclist point? That actually he's coming down. If he'd been in a ministerial car, they'd have opened the gates for him. Why? Because he's on a bicycle. Does he have to go through a pedestrian entrance?
I actually thought your husband must have phoned the Jeremy Vine show earlier, because it was genuinely
really not his style.
No, I thought not.
No.
But anyway, so that's one point. The other one, of course, is the public order offence or lack thereof or whatever. Well...
And does it amount to a public order offence? What was said, and would he have been arrested and charged with Section 5 public order if he hadn't been wearing a suit?
I did quite enjoy the senior police officer, I think from the Fed, if I remember rightly, on BBC News, who was saying that that he was very fortunate that he hadn't been arrested for a public order offence. I thought, well, hang on a minute, let's just go through exactly what was said. If this very senior police officer is telling us that he would have arrested him for, even at its height, what was supposedly said, I'm a little bit troubled that the senior police officer doesn't understand the requirements of a Section 5 public order offence.
Oh, I don't know. There were several shocked people. Apparently.
Yes, I noticed in the
where
report...
Where are the witness statements from those terribly shocked people?
Well, did you see... No, in the police report today, it was released yesterday, and it says... the officer had recorded that he saw a number of people stood by looking shocked. I thought, yes, I bet he did.
Yes, I've seen... how often have you seen that phrase in a police statement? Ian, how often have you seen that phrase in a police statement?
All the time.
And the other thing that I found interesting about the coverage of it is the very clear lack of understanding amongst our brethren in the press as to what a log is and when it was made. They keep talking about this sort of... dealing with it like it's a contemporaneous log and how they would have noted it down at the time. Not in a police incident log, they wouldn't.
Well, it's all very exciting. It kind of isn't, is it? Let's be honest. It's a pretty big non-story.
It is always funny when these things sort of explode into the real world and people start, you know, rather than just the legal world, we deal with them all the time, and then they just suddenly explode and people start getting on their high horses and have no idea what it's actually like generally.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... we're not going to do the politics of it, but I did quite enjoy Ken Clark's comment that, you know, this was ridiculous, it was all blown out of proportion, blah, 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 blah. He'd had a very stressful day, and which turned out to have been a day spent in a curry house and then a gentleman's club. But
very hard work.
Very hard work. But
I didn't know he'd heard that.
Yeah, yeah. But he said, oh, yes, it's terrible. Of course, you may remember that Ken Clark was the man who, can't even remember which conference it was now, said that the simple matter of even swearing at a police officer should be sufficient to be arrested and dealt with by the magistrates, except, of course, apparently, if you're the Tory chief whip. Anyway.
Maybe it should, but actually it's not an offence.
Well, so if you want to share your views, as I say... Well, I'll
go
tell you
phone
what,
Jeremy Vine.
Phone Jeremy Vine or Vanessa Feltz or whoever is on these days, or you could phone us. This is probably a reasonable time to give you our contact details.
But what is our number?
Unfortunately, I gave it to someone today, so it doesn't matter. It's 0161 408 5037.
Very good. Mm. Or you could follow us at Twitter, at NorthPod.
At NorthPod Law.
NorthPod Law, yes.
And are we going to try for the email address?
mail@northpod.co.uk.
Spot on, there you go.
There you go. It's only been 6 series.
I know, you're nearly getting it, yeah.
Also right. In the news.
Yep.
Abu Hamza, he is about to be deported imminently.
No.
No, he's not. No.
This is breaking news. Of course it isn't when you're listening to this on Friday lunchtime. But So on the way to NorthPod Towers today, first news story was that Abu Hamza was definitely about to be imminently deported. By the time I pulled up, passed through the large gates, which I was allowed through in my vehicle, and parked up,
I heard... That's because you don't ride a bicycle. You're a very naughty boy.
You're damn right I don't. So then by that point, apparently he wasn't being deported imminently. Do we know why?
No, we don't really know why. Although apparently there's a hearing at the High Court on Tuesday. There's two of them who are... due to be dealt with at the High Court, as I understand it, on Tuesday, although that's from Sky News and it was about 10 minutes ago, so it's obviously what they've heard through the grapevine as well, I would imagine.
Fair, well, as I say, by the time you're listening to this, you'll already know why that was, and that'll be fine, probably.
I think it's to do with them not being well enough to travel, which I think may have been suggested by the Today programme before his, even before his lawyers came up with it. I don't know.
You mean, anyway, let's just not touch that.
What I do think is that the reason that they're making the challenge is because Jonathan isn't here.
Yes, because he could probably tell us chapter and verse as to exactly what,
you know,
it is.
We've been following this. He's been doing every detail, and this is the show that he's not here when it's all over and he's going to be deported. In homage to Jonathan, his solicitors are clearly making this application.
I want to go back to that last episode in which he gave his final conclusion about Abu Hamza and find out whether he said, yes, that's it, he's definitely exhausted all routes, or whether he said, no, there may still be more.
I think he said he technically exhausted them. But you never really know.
Fair enough.
That's what he said.
Sitting on the fence, as always, right?
Also, you should all know this, actually, already. Dangerous dogs.
Yes,
the guidelines are in.
Talking of Jonathan. he's coming in for a bashing,
he
clearly,
is,
today.
He's not here.
The reason I say talking of Jonathan is that he was the one who did the detailed thing on the Dangerous Dogs Act on the previous show.
I'm going to ask Ben when that was, because I asked him to look it up.
Didn't.
No.
But you're listening to it online or somewhere, so you can probably see when we last covered it.
You remember we did cover it, and we went into it. It was a consultation, I think, at that stage. But in fact, what they were consulting on, the recommendations, were exactly what was taken up in the guidelines. So you can, if you want a bit of guidance on that, you can try and find that on the North Pod site.
So
but they came in, no, that's the 20th of August.
Oh, sorry, yes, quite right, 20th of August.
So, and that, with the exception of weekend courts, which I'm sure we'll cover later, because I'm sure Ian will have a view on it, that's pretty much the roundup of the news. That's everything that's been happening in the last 6 weeks while we've been off air.
It's the news that was, the week that was, or 6 weeks that was. Okay, so we can bring in now. Just by way of background, back in as far as 2003, and I was quite surprised by that, looking it up actually, that it was that long ago, the then government took the view that charging decisions in criminal matters should be taken out of the hands of custody sergeants, who previously had the authority in them, and handed over instead to the Crown Prosecution Service. It was politicised. The suggestion was at the time that the government had bowed to the lawyer lobby. Apparently we had a lawyer lobby then, do you remember?
No.
But there it is. Theresa May in 2009 set out her plans to reintroduce or to return those powers to the police in relation to summary offences. It hasn't happened yet. But we are joined by a solicitor who thinks it's high time. Ian, hello.
Hi.
Why is it high time?
Well, I think, and I was surprised as well when we talked about this earlier, and it transpires that the decision was taken away from, the decision-making power was taken away from them back in 2003. It felt as though it had only happened, say, 3 or 4 years ago, but it's been systematically a part of our practice for 10 years now. Obviously, we're getting on for 10 years. And I can understand the reasons why that happened under the last administration, and they were probably hopeful that they would be able to filter out a number of overzealous charging decisions from the process by filtering effectively through the CPS.
So what was the... Well, let's talk about the system as it was pre the changes, if you like. So there you are in a police station with your suspect on, let's keep it simple, some summary offence. Well, just talk us through the process, because, of course, a lot of our listeners will be people who've never been in that situation. Under the old system, what used to happen? What was the role of the custody sergeant?
Well, again, and probably for your benefit as well, Ben, because, of course, you'll be too young to remember this process. But in the ordinary course of events, pre-2003, the suspect would obviously be arrested, there being reasonable grounds for suspecting that he committed an offence. And thereafter, he'd be interviewed, he'd give his version of events to the officers in the case, who would then report their findings from the interview and from their gathering of the evidence in the early stages of the process to their custody sergeant, who would have sufficient knowledge and experience of being in that role to be able to call a decision as to whether or not, in his view, there was a realistic prospect of conviction, which was always the test and still is to a certain extent when considered by the CPS. And that person would either be charged, remanded to court, bailed to court, or the custody sergeant would rarely, I have to say, take the decision then to take no further action.
So that sounds fairly swift.
Yeah. And of course the drive nowadays is of course towards swift and short justice, as we're learning in other areas of magistrates' court practice.
Yes, we'll come back to the white paper of Nakurba in due course. Decision was taken then to move that power away to the CPS. Now the way in which that operates, or the way in which it was designed to operate, might be the safer way of putting it, would be that the Crown Prosecution Service would be presented with a summary of the information that the police had. That would consist of both the information that was, if you like, readily disclosable, or perhaps that had already been disclosed, of course, if somebody had been interviewed, plus also, in many cases, a lot of people probably don't realise, intelligence information that provides background from the police to the CPS. The CPS then will work their way through that information. Sometimes they will have sight of videos and whatever else, if there's CCTV or whatever else, and they will provide an advice back to the police.
Yeah.
Now, that can take some time. We've talked about the delay between between alleged offence and disposal in previous shows, but let's deal. I mean, your practice is in Oldham.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, it can happen very speedily.
Well, this is.
It doesn't always take a long time, does it?
At the outset, I think that was probably the intention.
Yes.
And certainly in the first couple of years, since the decision-making power was taken away from the sergeant, there was a system in which CPS lawyers would be given office space, for example, within the police station.
Yeah.
And were readily contactable by the investigating officers, certainly during office hours. But of course the problem then arises, as you know, how can you get the advice as readily as you would need to, assuming you're an investigating officer, during the hours of darkness or at weekends, for example, when there was no CPS lawyer present?
Of course no crimes ever take place in the hours of darkness or outside office hours.
No, absolutely.
All right, so you say that that's how it worked to start with.
Yeah.
A lot of people will realise that CPS offices, in fact, in some areas it's still the case, that there are CPS division departments within police stations.
Yeah.
Of course, of recent, particularly in this area, the CPS have been moved out of their regional offices, their orbital offices, and into, in Manchester's case, Sunlight House, or whatever.
Yeah.
Has that had any noticeable impact directly on the speed at which these things are done then?
Well, yeah, certainly I think it has, because there's a lower incidence nowadays, and certainly I'm not aware of CPS lawyers being in situ at certainly Chadderton Police Station, which serves the Oldham area, and routinely advice has to be obtained either over the telephone or by phone and so on and so forth to a CPS lawyer at a distance and then awaiting response. But what you're tending to find is that in situations whereby, for example, the outcome of an investigation is dependent on, for example, the availability of CCTV material, if the CPS lawyer cannot see that immediately, then the charging decision is therefore postponed, and invariably the suspect, and it strikes me that despite the severity of the matter under investigation, will be bailed for a period of weeks.
And we're talking about CCTV evidence that is frequently available to the police officer. He just has no way of getting it to the CPS.
That's right, yeah.
Now, the CPS will no doubt say that there are some systems which will compensate for that. For example, I suppose, those wearing lapel cameras, a bit of relatively new equipment, I suppose, for beat officers, that information is uploaded centrally to a system that the Crown Prosecution Service, at least in theory, are able to access fairly promptly.
Not outside of office hours, they're not.
Well, no, I was going to say, I'm presuming the case is that that's not the case outside of office hours. No,
my understanding of the position is, and you'll need to clarify this with the CPS, obviously,
yeah,
is that, you know, they have a rota, much the same way as they used to have for allocations to police stations, for members of their lawyer staff to be at home and ready to receive calls from the police. I might be wrong about that, but that's my understanding of how the system works out of regular office hours and at weekends. And clearly, in those situations, the level of technology that they have access to is limited, I think, to telephone calls and the passage of fax machine, fax messages and so on.
So the delay seems to be built into a system that isn't now working the way it was originally designed to work.
No, I think the situation has been slowed down by some measure. And if one takes account of the recent suggestions, and I'm talking about information in the press over the course of the last few months, and it's associated with this business about speedy justice, that cases are taking an average of 5 months from point of commission of an offence to conclusion of an offence, then I'm sorry, but you need to weigh that delay heavily against the period of time between commission of an offence and the awaiting of CPS advice.
Well, this is something that we talked about last series when we were talking about the white paper, but, well, give us an example in the Oldham area then of a fairly typical... Well, I'll tell you what, first of all, give us an example of one of the longest sort of series of bail backs you've dealt with.
Okay, well, in a recent case, and I'm talking about one that I'm still involved in because he's now in the Crown Court, but certainly within the last 12 months, I've had a serious rape allegation. Violent rape, offender known to complainant, with the central issue being one of consent. So clearly, all the DNA evidence was there at the outset, within the hours, the first few hours of the investigation. And in order for a CPS lawyer with a specialism, it appears, in sexual offences to properly consider that file, this particular suspect, as he then was, had to answer bail on no fewer than 5 occasions.
Over what sort of time is that, then?
We're talking about a period of 9 months.
So 9 months.
And in between that period of time, I was frustrated about the fact that this case was going nowhere. I wanted finality, obviously, for my client, the suspect. But obviously, I'm at that stage starting to have wider considerations for the implications of the complainant as well, because it's simply not fair to her either. Mm. So, in the course of my representing him ongoing, bail back would be extended yet again. I would then write a letter to the Divisional Crown Prosecutor at the CPS office for Oldham and say, what's going on?
Well, just pausing here for a moment. I mean, a lot of our listeners simply, they listen to this show because they have an interest in matters to do with the law and justice system, and they're not practitioners of any sort.
No.
We'll just help them out with this, because a lot of people will hear repeatedly in the media that defence lawyers, in fact, usually it's defence solicitors who are cited, want these delays.
Yeah, well, frankly, there's nothing in it for me financially to have delays in the system at all.
Actually, it costs you money.
Well, of course it does. And I think I speak for most practitioners. I would simply say this, that we don't like delay because we like finality in our cases, so that, frankly, and if I'm being totally honest, we can bill our cases quicker and it helps our cash flow. It doesn't help us if you regard cases as units, which often we have to if we're in businesses, to have those units lying around in filing cabinets for months on end. But that really isn't the point.
No.
The point is the wider public interest.
Well, you don't get paid any more.
No.
The longer it goes on, you get paid
don't.
A set fee.
Common misnomer.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to another point to do with the wider implications. So you've mentioned there the wider implications, first of all, obviously for impoverished lawyers. Secondly, for defendants who want finality in their cases.
Of course they do.
Or suspects as they are at that stage. Complainants, and I suppose you can include in that other witnesses as well.
I think that's the fundamental issue that people are losing sight of, which is the element of finality that suspects deserve and are entitled to expect, but moreover, and not strictly thinking about somebody who's acting for a specific defendant or suspect, as do complainants.
Yes.
Well actually, there's not just that, is there? I mean, in the case of a rape case, I mean,
yes,
not this one, but because I obviously don't know the details here, it's actually not a massive problem, is it? If he's innocent,
Yeah.
Not really a massive problem that he's out on the streets for 9 months, but if he's not innocent, I'm not too happy about him wandering about the place. Didn't you have a case a few years ago with a child sex abuse case that was then bailed off, and then he got charged? He was arrested again for a further offence.
Yes, we've had situations like that, but in specific reference to the rape case that I started talking about, net result of that was that after the 8-9 month period on police bail, when effectively nothing was happening, then charging decision granted by Crown Prosecution Service, and then flurry of activity.
Yeah,
and then because of the passage of time, and the suspect not being the most intelligent person in the world, had missed his sixth bail back date, and all the King's horses and all the King's men were dispatched to bring him into custody
because all of a sudden it was very urgent.
Because, of course, and then of course we've got issues of failure to surrender and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
You've also got the issues, haven't you? That to a large degree, although from the outset as a solicitor, you stop and say, "Well, where's this evidence? Where's that evidence?"
Yeah.
Your only ability to actually get somebody to order that evidence is secured is once we get to the court system, and once you've got past 9 months later, if you say, "Well, hang on a minute, she was, this is what was going on on the street. Where's the CCTV?" And they say, "Well, we're going to keep it 6 months."
Yeah,
and you've lost your defence.
Absolutely, and.
Or your prosecution evidence.
The prosecution, of course. Because, let's face it, the bare bones of a prima facie case can, I think, in the vast majority of cases, excluding the likes of serious fraud cases and so on and so forth, be established within the space of the first few hours.
Yeah.
And it's after the first few hours that the evidence trail begins to go cold. CCTV is routinely erased, recollections fade, DNA evidence may be lost. And to that extent, the vast majority of the investigative work can be done to a certain standard within that first day. And therefore, we're only really waiting for somebody at the CPS to turn up these files to make a call.
Now, I should probably say, in defence of the CPS, that one of the problems that they have is the lack of resources. In fact, also the problem for the police is the lack of resources. Behind the scenes, during bailback periods, there are quite often other things going on, such as actually an attempt to investigate matters. Now, of course, that is solely in the current system where custody sergeants have no input in this. That is solely the province of a CPS lawyer and whoever the officer in the case is.
Yep.
That didn't always used to be the case, because when you were dealing with a custody sergeant, of course, there was another person in the room quite frequently.
Well, actually, you haven't even got those two people now.
Well,
that's the other issue, is that they, most certainly in Greater Manchester, you now apparently don't have officers in the case.
Well,
you have an
true
officer in the case who is the person who was the officer, the uniformed officer at the scene.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the file processing unit, where they decide which team is going to deal with it.
Mm.
And then it's a team that deal with it. There isn't a set, you don't have an officer in a case. And similarly, at the CPS, I have to say my view is, because they have such a blame culture in the CPS, nobody has any file ownership. So although you may have a lawyer's name on it, well, they're not really the lawyer on it. There's no file ownership, no one taking charge at any point.
Well, okay, let's be charitable to the CPS then. Let's imagine you have a situation where there is somebody who's got their hands on it. They realise the importance of the case. They realise all of those wider concerns that Ian was talking about. And there is an officer who's got their teeth into it as well. Of course, that is a prosecutor who's, by their very nature, is there to look at the prosecution case, and a police officer who, by the nature of police culture, is, again, looking at the prosecution case. The point I was sort of arriving at, Ian, is that under the old system, the sergeant, the custody sergeant, would, of course, also in a lot of cases, particularly actually upon reflection, the cases like sex cases, have input from the defence lawyer who was present.
Well, yeah, that used to be the case, and I think the role of the defence lawyer or the defence representative in the police station has been eroded now to the extent that it's almost culturally accepted that the only purpose, as far as the police are concerned at least, for that person to be in the police station is because the police are ready to interview the suspect.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, PACE, which, if I'm not very much mistaken, hasn't been repealed yet.
Not yet.
Entitles the suspect to call for a legal representative, and they're entitled to speak to that person any time during police detention.
Yeah.
Whereas the police see it as... you know, the police tend to operate the system rather more to their convenience. But I understand the point that you were asking, and this is to do with the input from the defence representative. Mm. It might not be taken seriously at the custody desk, but nevertheless, the business of making representations to the custody sergeant prior to his then charging decision was one that used to be taken relatively seriously.
Yeah, and to work through an example of that, in a case where you have instructions from your client, the suspect, who says, no, look, seriously, this is all sorts of mistakes. In fact, look, if the CCTV from such and such a petrol station or whatever is obtained, then, you know, it will become really obvious that that's the case.
Yeah.
Now, that was the sort of situation in which a defence lawyer might well say, look, Sergeant, do you want to perhaps just go and check this little detail before you proceed to the interview?
But to follow your example, if that inquiry cannot or will not be conducted for whatever reason by the police at that stage, even though it was perhaps mentioned in interview, it might be put on the back burner for something to do in the subsequent few days. But certainly, whilst the suspect is then on police bail, the chances of losing that evidence might be lost.
Yeah.
But in the olden days, I can envisage a situation whereby the custody sergeant might then look at the interviewing officer and say, well, shouldn't this be done? Can't we do this now?
Well, the reason I raise that as an example is that one of the, I'm sure we must have talked about it on the show before, but one of the very common problems in the Crown Court, I'm sure it's exactly the same in the Magistrates Court, is that the first opportunity for someone to really poke and prod at the CPS and the police and say, no, look, this isn't good enough. Where is the CCTV from this place that was mentioned in interview? Or why have you not spoken to this alibi witness whose details we know you have? Or why haven't you disclosed the details so that we can investigate it? Unfortunately, because of all of these delays, that first opportunity in indictable cases is months and months down the line, by which point witnesses have disappeared or can't remember or evidence is lost or whatever else.
But the most troubling aspect of all of this is, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there, with the fact that this tends to relate more so to the more serious offences. Anything more serious, the highest end of towards the top of the pyramid, I should say, that is going to, by definition, attract a degree of complexity in terms of investigative work that still might have to be carried out, is more likely to end up in the hands of a CPS lawyer. And unfortunately, and I credit the officers where due, some of these officers concerned in the investigation of serious matters do know what they're doing and know their evidence, and have to wait for the CPS lawyer to make a decision. So effectively, you have a CPS lawyer directing a police investigation.
Well, that's what it comes down to, isn't it? So when you're looking at things like, I don't know, forensics and getting permission to undertake forensics work, of course, I'm sure every lawyer dealing with crime in the country will tell you that in cases that ordinarily there would have been fingerprint analysis or DNA analysis or whatever else, these days... first of all, it's very difficult to even get to the point of those analyses being done. And secondly, if you have one that is partially conclusive, let's say, for example, you've got a partial fingerprint match or something else, or there is some supporting evidence to say that the person was present, quite often that seems to be enough now to stop there being the further investigation, which then becomes a matter for trial, which then becomes a question of doubt, which then results in people, sometimes rightly, sometimes probably wrongly, being acquitted.
I mean, in essence, what concerns me from a wider, and I have to say, public safety point of view, and it might seem strange, these arguments coming from the defence fraternity, but the bottom line is, as a defence lawyer working at the coalface and working in the police station, one does gain, over the course of a number of years' experience, some sense of what's going on. And to be perfectly honest, and you know, certain recent tragic events have shown, that where people are on police bail, bad things can happen. Mm. And in essence, the net result of what we're talking about here is that because a CPS lawyer might not like the feel of a case within the first few hours, that matter requires further investigation, further consideration, and in the meantime, you go from a position where somebody who's under lock and key, suspected of a very serious matter, is released back into the community. Mm. So you're letting a caged tiger back into the city centre, potentially. And I would feel happier if that decision went back to the experienced custody sergeants who can make a call on realistic prospects of conviction, and thereafter we can argue the toss again within days, either at the magistrate's court or on a judging chamber's bail application that can be heard within a week.
Can I ask you this? Do you think that, actually, you're saying it's now been nearly 10 years since custody sergeants have regularly had that sort of power and
yeah.
that understanding? Do you think the nature of being a custody, well, of being a sergeant generally, has changed over those 10 years?
I think it has, and I think on talking to police officers, which I do informally about this topic, there is still a sense of resentment that the power is not there anymore, and over and above the fact that it's just a stripping of power for the stripping of power's sake, one can understand why there is a frustration on the part of the police that it was taken away in the first place. The only thing that concerns me is if the power were given back, as May suggested last year, in the majority of cases, that there would be a training gap over the course of the last 9 years and an erosion of the education that the sergeants necessarily have to fulfil their roles. To be able to do that properly.
I'm just thinking, you used to do cases, and you deal with police officers, and you know, you're always going to get cases where you think, crikey, you know, I'm dealing with idiots here, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then something, you know, you'd read through your statements, and then there would be a sergeant, and when you came to do, when you were planning your examination or whatever, you would think, breathe a deep sigh of relief and say, okay, we've got a sergeant, we're going to have somebody who's sensible to deal with it. I have to say, I tend to think of that now about inspectors. It's gone up a level, and I think that's happened over the last 10 years as well.
But their role at least seems to have been, and you know, I don't want to take anything away from the nature and the breadth of the role that they have to fulfil, is simply as people looking after people in cells awaiting the outcome of their cases. In other words, they're just key holders.
Well, I'll tell you what, for the first time in certainly this show, listeners know I do another one, but the first time in this show, someone's actually phoned and left us a voicemail.
Kirsten.
Hey. I know, and it's not even Jonathan doing a silly voice either.
Is it my mother?
It's not your mother either, so that's the other one who listens. no, this is a gentleman who's a former police officer. Let's just see what he says on the subject. Let's see if I can figure out how to dial him in.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Terry. I'm a former police officer, retired in 1995, and now work supporting criminal defence work with solicitors. I understand this evening you're going to talk a little bit about the role of the CPS in charging. Whilst I've got no direct knowledge of the CPS decision-making process these days, I just think back to my days within the police service when the custody or the charge sergeant had the discretion to accept a charge. That if at that stage when a charge was presented to him, there was some doubt, the doubt would inevitably have gone in favour of the police officer and not the accused. And so I presume that the rationale, one of the rationales at least, for involving the CPS in that, was to put some independence into the decision-making process. I don't know if that has any bearing on your discussion tonight, but it's just a thought. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Terry. That's a fair point, isn't it? So one of the pieces of rationale for taking the decision away was to provide a degree of independence, because the police would naturally want to a custody sergeant would naturally want to proceed straight away to support his officer's account and proceed to proceedings.
I think that I'm not sure that's entirely fair. I think certain custody sergeants would differ from others in the element of zeal that they would apply to the charging decision. But effectively, we've always had an injection of independence, and that's when the matter reaches court.
I'm not sure the CP. I'm not sure I'd agree that the CPS are actually any less likely to believe a police officer either. That they're not going to be take the
no,
same
they are very
to, take,
skeptical.
To take the same
yeah.
to say the same view actually.
Yeah, but I mean, there again, there is the wider consideration that possibly this power was taken away and given to the CPS for financial purposes. In other words, that the CPS would only want to charge those cases which were evidentially, as far as they were concerned, completely gift-wrapped and eminently convictable.
Is that necessarily true? I mean, it's there may be an element of cost-saving in this process, but is the cost that's being saved probably not a public funds issue in terms of defence lawyers? Because, of course, if custody sergeants were given that discretion back, we would fairly likely go back to seeing far more offences charged if Terry's right. Which means that, of course, there you go, you see,
it's
the lawyers are in it
again,
for the money.
Well, yeah, okay. Although there is the other argument in which you could say, well, the custody sergeants might take a more commonsensical approach to certain of the charging decisions, because we also know that the Crown Prosecution Service might be willing to run with a case that was not eminently convictable. Mm. And I'm thinking in terms, perhaps, of certain domestic cases in which there is a current public policy driver to charge against all the odds. Mm. And I'm not talking about
it
cases.
It certainly feels like that.
You're talking about domestic violence cases.
I'm talking about low-level domestic violence cases in which, again, through personal knowledge, and I'm only a small practitioner, so to extrapolate my experience across the profession, I think you'd definitely see a greater incidence of this. But those cases in which, for example, you've got a retraction statement which is already on the police file.
And you've also then got racism cases and the homophobic cases, anything that's got that has a political tag to it, really.
Yeah, it's got that feel to it, unfortunately.
Do you not think that the police are bound by those same sorts of policies as well, though?
Yeah, but we've got to go back to basics, and they might be bound by policies, and yes, it is desirable that domestic violence cases be pursued for fairly obvious reasons, as are cases with a racial element. Mm. But you've got to strip all that away and go back to the facts of the incident.
Simple evidence.
And say, is the evidence there?
You've also got a custody sergeant able to sit down with the officer in the case and take a realistic view of who is going to attend court, whether there's any room for doubt. It's just much easier to have that chat with somebody if you're a custody sergeant with one of your own team.
And of course, not sergeants, of course. I think I can't remember the minimum rank of officer for DVPNs and DVPOs. Is it? No one can remember. In fairness, they're very new. They're only just on trial in Manchester now.
On a public expenditure front, it just strikes me as bizarre that seemingly now, as a matter of routine, and it just so happens that Oldham Magistrates Court is the designated court for the, I think, the east of Greater Manchester, for DVPO applications to come forward, invariably following a decision to NFA, an allegation.
Well, that's what they're for. I mean, of course, a DVPN, a Domestic Violence Prevention Notice under the new scheme, you probably won't have seen them in most other places in the country. What they're there for is a case where you know that a suspected victim of domestic violence is not going to cooperate for whatever reasons, quite often because I'm sure people will realise it's one of the hallmarks of domestic violence, domestic abuse, in fact, which of course is now even wider under the new definition.
Yes.
Forgot to put that in the show notes. The reality is that they quite often won't be able to, on an emotional level sometimes, cooperate. Mm. And so the idea is, well, we've not got enough evidence to charge Mr. or Ms. Bloggs, who's being abusive and violent. So instead, what we'll do is, without the support of the victim, suspected victim, I should say, in cases, is we will impose upon the pair of them a requirement that they do not have contact for a period of time, after which We will go to a magistrate's court and ask a magistrate's court to impose it for longer. And if the person has breached it in the meantime, then that is even greater evidence in support of the requirement for the what becomes domestic violence prevention order. Sorry for the little law lecture there, folks, but it's probably important to know about those. But the reason I raise those is that it's those cases where a senior officer, and as you say, Kirsten, yes, it seems to be going up a level.
It's
not sergeant anymore for that sort of thing. I'm fairly sure it's inspector now for that. Authorises, having spoken to whichever officers in the domestic violence unit. So apparently we can trust these sergeants with some decision making without recourse to the CPS. The CPS have no say in that matter. That's a cost-saving method, isn't it?
Well, no, because in the instance of the DVPNs that we've been talking about, that obviously requires the police authority to bring those cases. All right, it's not a problem for the Crown Prosecution Service, but the police authority in question will then have to instruct counsel to bring those applications before the court within the 48 hours.
True.
And when they're contested, it's debatable. We don't have any statistics at the moment to know what proportion of those are succeeding or not.
No idea at the minute, no.
But
there's another cost inherent in that.
Yeah. But the key problem that I think we have at the moment as a society is that, yeah, okay, in the vast majority of less serious, low-level offences, a decision can be made relatively speedily. And I'm talking about regular recidivist shoplifters with a bad record who a custody sergeant could determine on an admission in the interview, for which CPS advice is not required, to lock up and get before a court as soon as possible. And frankly, these people who are either drug addicts or a bit sad or a bit feckless are not a danger to society, whereas I strongly suspect that those people who are in there for serious high-end stuff really should be brought before a court quicker.
So it's interesting, isn't it, as well, that for those with memories, Theresa May's proposals back in 2009 actually related to summary-only offences. So this is the lower end. You're basically saying, well, leave those where you want to leave them, Theresa. Instead, aim for the 20%, not the 80%.
Absolutely, yeah.
There we go. Right, well, you have an online petition in for people to sign. Doesn't have to be lawyers. You can be police officers, of course. I know we have some police who listen to the show. You can get on board with that. The address of which is?
It's basically the petition is to allow custody sergeants to make charging decisions in all criminal investigations. And that's been up now for nearly a week. And the where you need to go to get onto that petition is http://times2 ePetitions, all one word, /petitions/39042. So it's those last five.
Those digits.
It might just be in the show notes.
It probably will be, I think.
Oh, right.
I promise. Okay,
great. What we'll do is we'll put it in the show notes, but also if you're listening to this immediately and go, I must sign this right now,
yes,
what you need to do is just Google DirectGov ePetitions, and then on the ePetitions site, you'll find there's a thing to enter the petition number. Enter those last digits.
And if you can't remember the number, I think any
rewind
variation of use of the words custody sergeants charging will probably get you to the correct one. If you've got 90,000 friends, please get them all to sign it.
That's just under the number of listeners we have. So
debated in Parliament as quickly as possible.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
From one soapbox to another, possibly for you, Ian, I'm afraid. Although it could have been a lot worse.
Okay.
We had planned to start this series off with discussing weekend courts and where they were up to, and
I'm really looking
forward
to those, Kirsten. I love my job so much.
Well, I know that you, absolutely all of us want to work 7 days a week. If
of course we do.
You don't want any. I thought you already did pretty much, don't you?
But
you miss court, don't you?
Therein lies another problem.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly from a personal point of view, what I tend to find, not just in my office, but with other contemporaries in the field, is that, yeah, Monday to Friday is spent with the generality of work that you have to do in the magistrates' court, And every so often, a Saturday morning is so valuable to you because you will go into the office or you will take work home just in order to catch up to where you need to be for all that backroom stuff that you've got to do.
And the same applies to the bar. I mean, Saturdays and Sundays are quite often paperwork days.
Yeah.
And if they're not paperwork days, it's the days that you get a phone call when you're out in Asda in the morning from,
Wicks
from,
for me.
From people like Ian Owen.
Yeah.
Saying,
no,
just
he
one
does
quick
that, th- doesn't he?
It's terrible.
Well, exactly.
But yeah, absolutely. So instead of working 7 days a week with two of them working from home, you can work 7 days a week all from your local courts. But no, you won't have to for the following reasons. It was a rubbish idea. I'm just going to paraphrase
is
it that way.
Is that what they said? Let's go through very quickly. You remember that this was a idea to have courts open both Saturdays and Sundays.
Yes.
And so to extend Saturdays and to introduce Sundays. South Yorkshire and Humberside, it's been scrapped entirely. So Sundays have been scrapped entirely. Nottingham and Staffordshire never got off the ground. Liverpool has been postponed until further discussions, although despite intensive research, we do not know with whom.
This just shows you that solicitors in Sunderland and Liverpool are just basically lazy.
That's right. And they want to delay justice, I would imagine.
They want to delay justice, and they don't care about their clients.
Not in the slightest.
It's very, very sad.
Shall I move on then to Manchester, which has also had Sundays postponed? And it's still apparently Saturdays due to start somewhere, but we don't know what it is.
Three of us were all present at a very well attended meeting.
We covered at the end of the last
Manchester
series. Yes.
Oh, did you? I was sorry about that.
Regular listener.
Yeah, it's quite shocking, isn't it? Yes, we.
We covered
put forward several
and
of your views,
The representative of the court service,
Mr. McGladrigan.
He wasn't very compelling in any of his arguments.
Well, I think that's probably fair to say. I have spoken to him since.
I think he'd be a rubbish advocate.
Well, I spoke to him since and asked him whether we could have the success criteria, which you may remember from the end of last series we were talking about, and the answer was that they weren't yet in a publishable format, but he would have them imminently, possibly even by the end of that week or some weeks ago, not had them, but now we know why. It turns out that it would have been pointless anyway. But it hasn't been in Manchester, it hasn't been entirely...
but I also have to say, in his favour, actually, I thought he did a very good job in terms of an advocate, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only so much you can go with a really rubbish plan that you've got to put out, isn't there?
I thought he did the very best anybody could have done, actually.
My
earlier points were completely unfair. He's not a rubbish advocate, but he had a rubbish argument.
Absolutely dreadful.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. So Manchester, it's been... Yeah, Sunday's been postponed.
Yeah.
Saturday's allegedly still due to start, but they're in some kind of discussions in the same way that they're in some kind of discussions in Liverpool, but we don't actually really know what that is.
There is no start date as yet, or at least if there is, it's not been published.
Newcastle has got to the stage where we were at 6 weeks ago in Manchester, in that it has been announced, but there are ongoing discussions. We can only assume it's going to go the same way as all the others.
It's got a little bit bloody in Newcastle because there are talks about bringing in solicitors from outside of the area to cover the courts that the local solicitors are refusing to cover. You can imagine how well that's gone down.
Yeah.
Well, like Nordic solicitors, for example.
I would imagine so.
In Newcastle.
We can vary the jurisdictions and bring some of the Scottish lawyers down as well. Yeah.
So, and also South Wales, Southampton, and Chelmsford, I think it was.
Chelmsford? Chelmsford?
Was it Chelmsford?
Yeah.
You said it very quickly. I wasn't really listening.
Chelmsford
is known
for its cattle market, I think.
They're looking at evening courts, but there are problems with the start dates in any event rather than the thing. And I understand in Birmingham.
Yes.
They're moving to an entirely different system of allowing people to get married instead.
Yeah, well, now, those of you who aren't familiar, and why would you be, with the interior of Birmingham City Magistrates Court, it is something of a peculiarity. It's, from the outside, I'd say it's really rather grim, but you sort of wedge your way through the little security doors and you walk into a Victorian, if I'm not mistaken, really quite beautiful main hall, which is reminiscent of the main hall at the Court of Appeal. Actually, it certainly is a building with some character. Although I have to say, you don't have to stray far out of that main hallway to get into something that's really rather more traditional magistrates' court fare. It's a bit grim in places, but anyway, the decision there has been taken that it would be a far more, I suppose, fiscally responsible thing to do to let that building out at weekends for weddings than it would be to have weekend courts in there. So I'm just trying to get the priority straight. If I understand it now, I'm just trying to apply that to Nick Herbert's white paper. So victims come first. No, hang on. No, that's not right. Weddings come first, then victims. And there, I think somewhere down the line, someone mentioned suspects, but...
No, I don't think suspects, aren't the list of priorities.
So you're back with another series and just a sarky. The other thing is, incidentally, did you know you can hire, if you want to film, so if we decide to film North Pod Law one day...
Excellent.
We can have Birmingham Magistrates Court for an entire day for filming for only £1,500.
Mm.
I think that's quite good. They haven't published the wedding rates, though. They're going to be twice that, aren't they?
Probably. Yeah. There's always a bit of a fleecing going on, isn't there, with all with...
Well, as soon as you put the word wedding in the front of any sort of product or service, it doubles in price, as I understand it. I've just become a best man in a wedding, and I'm realising that now.
Somebody trusted you as a best man?
It's all right, he doesn't listen to the show, he doesn't know anything about it. Anyway, so there you go. So the plans have been shelved or binned or suspended or whatever else in various different ways. If, of course, the Saturday court... the extension of the Saturday courts continues in Manchester, it would appear that the position of Manchester solicitors has not changed, which is no.
But it's all very firm now. I don't think there's a single firm actually now saying that they would even contemplate taking part.
Saturday court will remain what the Saturday court always was. I won't rehash all the arguments, but I will ask you this, Ian. I mean, in fact, actually, in your case, it probably would affect you even more because you're a solicitor in one of the orbital towns of Manchester where your name does not appear on the Manchester duty rota. Mm. Therefore, anybody brought in from Chadderton Police Station that might otherwise have been yours on a Saturday morning under the court duty scheme there would be handed over to a Manchester firm who they never deal with, and the Manchester firm they are then picking up here would be expected to then deal with the first stages of their case, possibly even the conclusion of their case. How does that feel to you?
Well... My understanding of the situation was that were the plan to take the shape that the court service wanted it to, that the duty rota would be redrafted to allow for those court duty listers who would ordinarily have been on the satellite courts had they remained in their venues and locations would then be interposed on the Manchester Saturday Sunday court scheme.
Surely that would have caused some difficulties for locality of defendants.
So. No. I'll come to that in a minute. My understanding of the situation was that there would be three courts open in Manchester's building, and one of those three courts, assuming that one and two were dedicated to Manchester and Salford Central work, would be given over to satellite work. Okay? So... we would then have a wider duty rota from the sort of Tameside, Stockport, Oldham areas in that third court in Manchester. But my fear was that, of course, what often happens is that I personally may have a client who's locked up in Chadderton Police Station, and sometimes a number of clients don't ask for a solicitor before interview, are interviewed, are charged, don't say anything until they get to the cells the following day, in which case they would then put their hand up in Manchester and say to the one of the jail staff in Manchester, look, my solicitor is Ian Owen from Oldham.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have a clue how to contact me.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, that client who's just anxious to be dealt with by somebody might put his hands up for an available Manchester City Centre due to this to statistically would be from one of the bigger firms.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, the case could be duly dispatched, guilty plea entered, etc., and wrapped up before I even got to find out about it.
And from a defendant's point of view, let's imagine that there's not a guilty plea there on that first hearing, despite the fact that's clearly what's envisaged of everyone. The problem you would then have is a number of people from the orbital towns represented by Manchester firms, and so having to step outside of their area to come and seek
assistance. Possibly not, because in the situation that I've described, then the case would then, you know, lawyers, as you've already said, being anxious to get their hands on the money, would have submitted an application for legal aid there and then, and then you'd have a situation, you know, the undignified spectacle of a lot of legal aid transfer arguments in the following weeks.
As those
satellite firms had handbag fights with city centre firms to try and get the client back.
That sounds productive.
Yeah, so it's just another of the very many tremendous spin-offs of the idea that temporarily we understand is not going to happen.
Well, perhaps if yes, perhaps we should all shut up about it, really, and then maybe it'll go away. Maybe they'll forget about it.
Yeah. Generally the approach to the MOJ, just shut up, just and, maybe shut you'll up go and
maybe you'll go away. Right, yeah. So we've touched on the domestic violence changes. I think we may cover those in the next few weeks. Although it came to news to me, I have to say, that it doesn't cover 16 and 17-year-old victims.
No,
probably
it doesn't.
Not right. Domestically violated. Court of Appeal are bringing out new guidelines. These are due out, I think they're in force, are they? From the guidelines, aren't they?
So yeah, from the 1st of October they will be rigidly enforced, is what the Court of Appeal have said. I won't bore you with the details, because unless you're a practitioner who is regularly submitting things to the Court of Appeal, you probably don't care. What I will say is that if you are in that position, I'm sure you've probably received it from another reputable source, such as Crimeline or somewhere. But if not, just go back and remind yourself. The useful thing about it is, if you've ever been in that position of submitting authorities to the Court of Appeal, the problem is there were bits of guidance kicking around in practice directions and all sorts of other things. There were established words of wisdom in things such as Archbold and Blackstones. But actually, there was no definitive, thorough instruction as to what was expected and required. That has now changed. There is. You can find it on the justice.gov.uk website, and if nothing else, just Google it, or go on to Crimeline's website, and I'm fairly sure that I saw it published through there somewhere.
All right.
It's easy enough to find.
All right. Now, we've had a bit of a go, I have to say, as usual, as you would, our loyal listeners would only expect, at the police this week, but we do recognise here in North Pod Towers that the police do, a lot of them do, an absolutely sterling job, and it is a very dangerous job, and we'd like to pass our condolences on to the families of Fiona Bone and Nicola Hughes, who are the two officers who were shot in the gun and grenade attack in Manchester.
Right, well, thank you very much, Ian, for joining us this week. Thank you to Terry Fox as well for contacting us on the phone.
Can I say, if you do want to get hold of Ian at any point, his firm is IJ Owen at Oldham, and those details, of course, will be in the show notes.
Absolutely. And if you want to contact the show, then you've heard the ways you can do it. Leave us a voicemail. We'd like to hear from you. 0161 408 5037. We are at the wrong one again, at NorthPodLaw
on Twitter, and you can mail us at mail@northpod.co.uk.
You can. And what's your website, Ian?
It's www.ijon.co.uk.
Just before the music ran out. Thank you very much.